And we welcome in Bruce Jenkins. Bruce, good morning. How are you?
Good, Marty. How are you?
Very good. And, you know, I always say, can lightning strike twice? And it did. You wrote about it. And, my God, well, what did you think watching this thing last night?
Well, not only that, it struck in the middle of the night. That makes three times.
I know.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, this you could see it unraveling, but this can't happen again. It's just not this soon, not two in a row. And I didn't expect it from Canada, but, you know, good grief. You know, the thing I took away from mostly, I guess, is that Trevor Gott has shown the Giants that he's probably the best option they have as a closer. He proved that early on. But, you know, his fastball is straight as a string, Marty. And sometimes he blows guys away, but sometimes he doesn't. And he puts it right down the middle, and Canada just jumped all over it. And that's not the first time guys have gone deep on him. Not saying that he's a disaster out there, and I don't think the Giants will give up on Gott, but I'm not sure what their options are, and I wouldn't be surprised if they at least try some other people as the season goes on.
Well, I think so. And the thing that got me, Bruce, in watching the last two nights, and I don't know, maybe it's a cosmetic thing, and maybe I put too much emphasis on it, but nobody goes out to calm the waters, as Bill Lasky likes to say. I mean, at some point, after you almost hit Chapman, it was lucky they didn't hit him, and then Olsen got the walk, and all this chaos is going, and this guy's throwing the ball all over the place. Don't you come out and say, son, hell's afloat here. Billy's getting mad, you know, like Art, yeah. Art Fowler used to say.
Well, for one thing, you don't have a guy like Dave Righetti, you know, going out there. And Gabe probably isn't getting mad. He's pretty even tempered. You know, their coaching staff isn't littered with people who can calm waters in a crisis. And I think also all around baseball, teams are very reluctant to gather in any way to get close to somebody to talk to them. You're wearing the friggin' mask, and the pitcher isn't, and it's just something you don't want to do. So I think there's a lot of factors there. But you know, I think if they had somebody like you know, like Dave Righetti, a really established pitching coach who's been known to you know, work miracles with guys and is very trusting, that might be a little different.
All right, that's a good point. No, that's well taken. Darren Ruff, I thought, a big home run. There are a lot of good things. The Giants should be up 2-0 in this series. Gausman pitched very well. The bullpen behind them was good. Watson was solid. Cueto was good the night before. So Ruff hit the big home run last night, too.
Yeah, once again, the right-handed hitting lineup is just, you know, every night it's proving its worth. I don't think there's any doubt that facing a lefty, the Giants are going to put runs on the board. They're putting them up consistently. It's reached a point where it's not some flukish thing. That right-handed hitting lineup is going to more often than not get you 5 or 6 runs, which is what, you know, usually would take to win a game. You know, there is a lot of bright spot in the rotation with Gausman's been, you know, very good. Cueto is very good. And, you know, you kind of hope that Logan Webb, you know, puts together a few good outings in a row. Smiley's hurt right now. But, you know, there's some good things are happening in the rotation. It's just the team, I tell you. I don't know, snake bit isn't the word, but they set themselves up for failure with these horrible defensive plays, Marty.
Yeah.
You just can't do these things, and it happens almost every night.
Yeah. They shouldn't be enough to sink you.
Right.
But they have been. But they have been.
Mm-hmm.
What happens afterwards? Hey, I had an interesting discussion with Ron Wotus this morning. He got a good view of two great third basemen, Matt Chapman, of course, and Evan Longoria. And he said, Chapman plays so deep, Bruce, he's on the grass. It's like Ernie Lombardi was up. You know, they used to move the infield back, you know, to the outfield for the slow-footed catcher of the old Cincinnati Reds and Boston Braves who won batting titles. But Woe said something interesting, and that is, and I brought it up, I said, Chapman throws on the run a lot. Woe says that's what they teach now. Don't get set. Come in, get the ball, throw on the run. It's okay. And I think it's havoc on your arm.
Well, you know, it is. And, you know, Chapman's made a lot of one-hop throws this year. More often than not, Olsen bails him out, but you can't do it every time. I think when Chapman gets set, his throws are, you know, a thing of beauty. So I disagree with that. If you have time to get set, it doesn't make sense. And it is an awkward motion. I don't think it's too terribly tough on your arm, especially if you're throwing it sidearm or even down below that. If you're trying to throw over the top, that could be a problem. But it doesn't make sense that that is just the way to go.
No, well, Woe said that Tulowitzki told him, because Woe was talking to Tulowitzki about Crawford, and Tulo said, well, I love the kid, but, you know, he gets set when he throws. He should keep moving. And that's what, if you think of Tulowitzki, how he played, Bruce, he played like his hair on fire. He got the ball and just, you know, was always moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with a guy like Tulowitzki, who people may forget was absolutely phenomenal at shortstop in his prime. And of course, you know, when you go deep in the hole, you're going to have to be making throws that where you're not even close to being set, and that has to be part of your game. But I think if the ball's in front of you and you have time to just get set, I think it's hard to argue that there's another way to do it.
Well, we'll see. I'm going to watch it today, see how that works out. Big day in baseball today. They do honor the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues. And, Bruce, there's a movement to include all Negro League players, just like they do for American League, National League, Union League, and everything else. If you appeared in a box score, no matter how sketchy it was, you played in the major leagues, and I think it's a great idea. I think it's great for history, great for families, and that's the trend. I hope they adopt it.
In terms of the statistics?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't do that. Nobody faced each other. I mean, how can you say that he hit 338 against a certain bunch of guys? Now, absolutely, the talent level was equal, I believe. I think it was superior in a lot of cases in the Negro Leagues, but there's no context. You know, he never faced Lefty Grove. He never faced, any of those guys. You know, the early Warren Spahn. I mean, you can't do it. The first thing you have to do is publish the Negro League statistics. I mean, where are they? All in one place. That's the first thing you do, and make it widely distributable so people can study it and realize what people did. I mean, I'm not sure the stats are all that trustworthy in some cases, just as they're not so trustworthy in the early days of MLB. You know, Satchel Paige used to change his own stats daily. He'd tell somebody what they were. What the hell? How are you gonna conflict? You know, then the next day it'd be a different set. I mean, it's all too vague for me to just all of a sudden compare Rogers Hornsby and Josh Gibson on their stats as if they played against each other.
Well, I think my thought is it's the history of someone who did appear in a box score, not necessarily comparing Hornsby with Josh Gibson. But just the fact that you did play, and we should consider it a major league, it would have been a major league, but for the color of your skin. And I think that's where they're going with it.
Well, I agree with everything that brings it to light. I just don't think you suddenly rearrange it. And you're looking at the top 10 career batting averages, and first of all, you'll have guys from you might as well put in guys from 1890 who hit like 480, you know, and then you got Cool Papa Bell in there, and then there's Hornsby and Gehrig, and I mean, it's too much for me. It doesn't make sense.
All right. Well, we'll see where it goes, but that's the trend, is to at least acknowledge the people played.
Well, and definitely. The more of that, the better.
Yeah, I think that's where we're going with it. A couple of things in baseball history for you and I today. A couple of birthdays. Al Holland. Forget about Al Holland. Al Holland was terrific for the Giants. Good relief pitcher.
Yeah, that was a good trade. You know, good hard throwing lefty out of the bullpen. He had a lot of guile and moxie. He wasn't afraid of the big moment. And should be well remembered. You know, it's one of those names that it doesn't come up like, you know, Lincecum or Kane or, you know, guys that you so often associate with the Giants. And, you know, he bounced around a little bit, but he was a good Giant while he was here.
Yeah, and I think that's one name that we sort of forget about. But, boy, he threw hard, and he was a good closer. The other one, a birthday today, he's long gone, but he was the third baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies. And, Bruce, it's one of those names like a Salahima. I just like saying it, Willie Pudd'nhead Jones.
Pudd'nhead Jones, absolutely. Where were we? I'm not sure how he got that name.
Kids made fun of him. And they made fun of him as a kid, so they said he had a pudding head.
Yeah, third baseman. He played a long time. He played like 15 years. He was all over the map, mostly with the Phillies. I don't think he ever hit 300. He got a little bit of MVP conversation in the late 40s and early 50s, and had a little bit of power at a 25 homer year one year. And he was just a solid player. He's one of those guys who was a big league regular for a decade. And there's a lot to be said for that. In those days, making the major leagues was just such a hell of a thing that there were so many minor league teams, and you had to work your way up from A ball to B. There was a class D, or there were thousands of minor leaguers compared to like none today. But he's one of those guys where you had the baseball card and you kept getting it every year. So we got to pay attention to this guy.
Willie Pudd'nhead Jones. I just like saying his name. You brought up a good point. What's going to happen with the minor leagues next year? Are they going to come back?
It's a huge thing for the Giants, because right now they're suffering through a season in which they can't look at guys like Ramos and Luciano and Canaria and all these. They have so many very promising players. Hunter Bishop, there's no way to really look at them. I mean, they can be at the alternative side, and I guess it's fairly competitive, but no, that's nothing like you're facing other teams who really want to get you out. Really pitching you tough, and they don't have that. They lose a whole year of that, and when they talk about the complications in getting a universal vaccine, it's very possible that we come back next year with no fans in the big leagues, and therefore in the minors, and the minors can't exist without fans.
That's right.
That's how they survive. They're already dying. The teams, the guys, the men and women who own those teams are just at wit's end right now. They're wondering if they can survive this financially. And a lot of them won't be able to. But something has to happen next year, even if it's a dire situation. Baseball has to come up with something where the team, at least the teams, can put together one minor league club. And they all play. Maybe they play in a bubble. I don't know what. But you can't lose the minors. And the Giants especially can't lose the minors.
Boy, I'm with you 100%. Last one for us, 1965. Masanori Murakami, his only start for the San Francisco Giants. Of course, the first Japanese player to come over. Relief pitcher for many, many, many games. 54 games, only one start. But he was terrific, then went back to Japan on an international incident about his contract. But they actually started him on today's date. He went 2 1/3, 4 hits, 3 runs. He was a heck of a pitcher for the Giants, 64-65.
Yeah, that was a huge deal. He was the first Japanese player to come over here from the Nankai Hawks. And the original deal had him going to Fresno, which was a Giants single-A team at the time. But he looked so good, they brought him up in August, and he made his debut, I think, in early September. And the Nankai Hawks wanted him to get right back to Japan. This is a young guy he was kind of a legend over there. He was pitching professionally when he was still in high school, and they wanted him to come back really bad. And the Giants managed to work it out where they got one more season out of him, and he was very good. I was looking up that 65 season, which is what the one full season he had with the Giants. He only got 2 hits, but one of them was a bunt single to third off Koufax.
Wow.
How about that? he can tell people that it was a ringing single that undressed the third baseman.
He still comes around. We still see him.
Yeah, yeah.
This is
a very historic figure. Yeah.
Yeah, and they made fun with him because he couldn't speak English. So they would tell him if Herman Franks came to the mound, he would say to Herman, "Take a hike, Herman."
That's great. Yeah.
Baseball.
Yeah.
One last one. It is Sunday. I love Sunday baseball. And I was just thinking of a doubleheader. 1975, Earl Weaver's tossed by Ron Luciano. And those are the days when the umpires really were very active and very aggressive and big guy. Weaver got tossed in the first game, came out with the lineup card for the second game. He didn't even get out of that before they kicked him out again. How about that?
Yeah, that was the ultimate manager-umpire confrontation, because even then, I mean, you know, the really good umpires like Nestor Shylock and those guys, Doug Harvey, they were pretty stoic. I mean, they'd argue, they'd get right in there and make their point very forcefully. But Ron Luciano was a guy who he was sounding like a guy, you know, in a bar. He's just
he's a wrestler, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Pro football.
And he's, you know, didn't they have it mic'd up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and here's Earl Weaver who go out there with the most colorful language you've ever heard and flip his cap around and kick dirt, and it was great theater.
Hey, I did mention Art Fowler, the pitching coach for Billy Martin, and that was the thing that he would come out and say, you're starting to piss Billy off, you better start throwing strikes.
Yeah, two things. Throw strikes, buddy. That was basically it. And if it really got bad, throw strikes, buddy. Billy's getting mad. It's funny because Fowler pitched for a million years, right?
And that's right.
And he definitely knew about pitching, but you always wondered how much he really knew, whether he was just sort of a comforting fact, comforting guy to come out of there. You know, but at the same time, you know, the A's assembled a fantastic starting rotation, and you know, Billy, that wasn't all Billy's work for sure. I mean, Art Fowler worked with those guys, and they all had it going there for a while. So I guess they needed Art to come out a little earlier in the game and get him out of there before they went 14.
I don't know. It's a warm part of baseball. I like it.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, hey, have a great Sunday. We'll see if lightning can strike again. Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Hopefully just in scattered parts of the Bay Area. That wouldn't be so bad.
All right. Have a good afternoon. Thanks, Bruce.
Okay.
All right. More coming up. Kerry Crowley next, right here on the Sports Leader.